Hello and welcome to episode 19 of the Data Driven Security Podcast. Welcome to episode 19 of the Data Driven Security Podcast. My name is Jay Jacobs, and joining me as usual is Bob Rudess. Bob, how are you this evening?
Sober.
Okay.
But that's kind of always the case when we're podcasting.
Right, so. Yeah.
Or it's kind of always the case, pretty much. I leave kind of a little more
up. We don't go around saying, well, what are you drinking tonight, Bob?
Yeah, sort of a boring data-driven lifestyle we sort of have. So.
Well, I'm drinking water. By the bucket load.
I got some kombucha. That's got like 1% alcohol, but
oh, I didn't know that.
Well, it's the good ones do anyway. The normal ones like 0.5 or whatever. But yeah.
Sure. So that was more social introduction than we've done in many an episodes.
Well, that just shows how relaxed we are from taking the summer off.
Yeah. Yeah, we did take the summer off. We had about 2 months off of the podcast there. And I think we're back now. I mean, school's getting back up, you know, for the kids and stuff. And I think we're going to see a couple episodes pretty quick here. And we're back in the swing of things. And so while we're talking about the back in the swing of things, though, if anybody listening either does data-driven security, has some interest, or has some topic that you think would be interesting, or know somebody that might make a good candidate, definitely reach out to Bob or I and say, you know, hey, I know this guy, or I know this person, or, you know, I want to talk about this. Would this be interesting? I think, you know, we've got people we want to bring on, but we're always looking for new and interesting people, or even halfway interesting people. And we, you know, so
I would argue that if you can at least even spell data-driven security, you should contact us.
We got to be careful what we say here. So, people should be able to reach us. You know, we're on Twitter. We're on dds.info, datadrivensecurity.info.
There is a very high probability, with high confidence as well, too, around that, that if they are listening to this podcast, they know how to find us.
Yep. We are not exactly hidden. So, Bob, one of the things that you've been doing, especially on our little hiatus here, is cranking out our packages. And when I say cranking out, I mean like mass production of our packages, specifically a lot of security packages, a lot of non-security too. And one of the creations of this summer is our OpenSec. Do you want to introduce that and talk about what that is and the concept behind it?
Yeah, because it's a good precursor to our secret surprise guest that we have on today's episode. But the goal here is, right, so up until the past maybe 18, you know, 20 odd months since we've had Data-Driven Security, the book out, the R has not exactly been the place where, you know, security geeks hang out. You know, it's sort of that like upscale high fine dining restaurant of security people versus like the low end gutter that Pythoners hang out in. And so really it was in need of some serious tooling if we wanted to start working with security data within it. And you know, to that end, you know, since we started this whole thing, I sort of seemed like I felt a little responsible as part of this to make sure we had enough of those things out there. And you know, our guest is somewhat of a kindred spirit with that, because he actually cranks out the R packages and some security related to it, as you're going to find out. But you know, to make it easier, we're going to start posting some links about, and you know, really just kind of jump on the whole R OpenSec bandwagon, which is basically if you have anything that relates to processing security data and it's using R, or there's an R interface to something else that actually works with security data, you have a home, and we'll be glad to put it in there and either, you know, bring it under the fold of the R OpenSec organization under GitHub or just kind of link to it or fork the repo or whatever. But we have everything in there ranging from, you know, a relatively new modern HoneyNet package, all the way to basically being able to work with you know, TCP/IP and UDP packet captures, you know, from PCAPS, a brand new updated Shodan library, which actually works really well. We had a blog post on that not too long ago that actually interfaced the Shodan output with the Leaflet library, Which a lot of people really seem to like a lot. So you can kind of do some fun there, but there's a whole bunch of stuff in there. Some of them are actually core R packages. I say core, like they're not part of base or anything, but you've got the OpenSSL package, which has been around in R for a long time. The PKI package, which does a fine implementation of the X509 standard, and a bunch of others. And our guest has a bunch of others too, which he's going to actually talk about. So I won't steal his thunder for there. But really, we're linking to more from in there, basically forking the repos, but we'll be glad to host them as well too. So, along with just talking about being on the show here, if you've got anything like that or want to start working in those things, take a look at some of the code there, because a lot of this stuff is just kind of making API access in R to a lot of security services that are out there. And again, the more that is in there with R, the less you have to kind of, make features in some other program to do data science in R with, and kind of keep everything kind of unified under one umbrella. So I think it's a great thing. Veris R is the package that Jay wrote for the book, and also for the DBIR. That's coming in there soon. You are nearly done revamping that one, right?
It is done. It's just not in the head of the branch there.
Gotcha. And we really should try to get that on CRAN, not just because of the fact that it's in the book, but just because it's a really useful tool to work with Veris data.
Yeah. Yes, it is, definitely. Yeah. And that'll be I'll have to work that in between podcasts and other events.
Yeah, the one thing that I will put out as another call for folks is if you happen to be really good at compiling stuff under the alternate tool chains, so not the Microsoft stuff, but the other the other open source compilers under Microsoft, and or even have R experience doing that, there's a number of C packages that both our guests and I have been putting out there, and we both don't do Windows. We really make no bones about that. And if you would have any of that experience and want to lend a hand there, we could really use that, and you will so get promoted like heck from us, and we'll give you a free copy of the book, give you a free copy of the DBIR and print everything, whatever you want. But yeah, it would be a big help if we have any really hardcore Windows folks out there to give us a hand with that. But enough about us. It's time to introduce our guest, Oliver Keyes from the Wikimedia Foundation. We're just going to jump right in and we'll let him talk about who he is and what he does and why we're talking to someone from the Wikimedia Foundation about data-driven security. Oliver, welcome to the show. And I'm curious, as I think all of our listeners are going to be, to discover exactly where you work and what you do. Because it can't be that you just work on creating R packages all day.
It would be really nice if it was. Some utopian day, that will be my job. And no doubt I'll get imposter syndrome and decide I'm bad at it. I work at the Wikimedia Foundation, the nonprofit that runs Wikipedia. On paper, I'm a human-computer interaction researcher. I study how humans behave on the internet, which is the boring kind of human-computer interaction. Some of my friends get to build robots for NASA. In practice, I do pretty much anything that needs to be done, because there aren't that many of us. Wikipedia is a top 10 site with 200 people. So I do research. I also build the tools needed to get at the data and parse the data and merge the data and everything else. It's an interesting job with no 2 days in a row alike.
And you do some security. So just since we are the data science podcast, you actually end up doing some security as part of your work then too, right?
Yeah, incidentally and deliberately. So by incidentally, I mean a lot of the data sets I have to deal with are precisely the same data sets that concern security researchers in a lot of areas, right? Access logs of all stripes and all types. Getting that data, turning it into a usable format, and being able to do stuff with the columns like geolocate things or pass URLs or work out what user agents are. And then deliberately, we have a very, very strong commitment to privacy as an organization. So making sure that all the data is locked down really, really tight. If anything is released, it's anonymized very strongly, that kind of thing. And at the same time, because we lack frameworks for doing a lot of basic things, a ton of questions I try and answer are the same as security researchers for a similar purpose. As a good example of this, our API doesn't require access keys of any type. It also doesn't require rate limiting of any type. So a lot of the work I do is sort of trying to identify outliers or examples of data sets we have where the data has been intentionally manipulated by automated agents from outside and working out where that's happening and when that's happening in a way that doesn't require me to manually hand code a billion log requests every day.
So do you actually end up interfacing just with like raw files, or do you hit like, you know, do you have like giant central log stores, or like, you know, how since it is, you know, the Wikimedia Foundation, this scale must be fairly huge.
Oh yeah. We get 125,000 requests every second or minute. I could never remember. And I sort of end up dealing with both logs. So we have the past logs, which are great. Those are stored in a big HDFS cluster that we have, and that's got everything. And then we've got 1 to 1,000 sampled files just stored as tarballed TSVs, unquoted, unsanitized, un-everything. And depending on the task, you might want to be using one set of files, you might want to be using another. If the cluster is particularly overloaded, there's a load of regular queries running, use the sampled logs. If you want a job to run every day without falling over, use the cluster. So yeah, it's both is the answer.
Do you have to touch like Excel files and things like that too, or do you just kind of get to work with like the Wikimedia server data?
Most of the time, I've managed to stay clear of Excel. There have been some interesting occasions involving PowerPoint and people expecting me to do things in PowerPoint. But yeah, mostly it's raw access logs, which is nice in a way in that it was designed by people who cared about it not being very difficult to deal with. In other ways, it's more of a full problem. You can't store complex data in it. When we have stored complex data in it, it becomes a devil of a time to sort of handle the file accurately and parse it.
And you don't just work with that on kind of the back end and do like cool like data science-y stuff. You actually like do some dashboarding and stuff too, right?
Yes. When I said I did everything that needs being done because there's not many of us, I meant it. So yeah, let's use the example of the dashboards to demonstrate this. So we've got a set of dashboards for the search team, which is the team I work on at the moment. They're written in R as a Shiny application. They work pretty, pretty well. And then there's a back end of a mix of R and Python, depending on the task. So my job was first write big bits of Java in our HDFS cluster so that the data could be extracted, then write R scripts which call it and save the data in a common format, then write the dashboards, and then do things with the results on the dashboards and present them and so on and so forth. So it's every step of the process, which makes for some interesting times. And is probably responsible for my sort of contributions to the wider R community being all over the place.
So, Oliver, how did you get into this job? How did you get into working with data like that and fall into it and R and all of that good stuff? How did you get here, basically?
Through a fairly weird path. So I started off as a lawyer in the UK. And then when I was in a particular moment of sort of idle, I don't know what the hell I'm doing, why did I decide to do this, I got a phone call from the head of engineering at Wikimedia because I'd been volunteering for the org since I was 15 or so. And they were like, we need a community manager in engineering. We don't have one. You sort of understand how the community works because you're in it. Would you like to do this job? And I signed up to do the job, and I did it for about 2 years. And towards the end of my tenure, we ended up running into throughput problems, namely that we had in the entire organization a researcher. And when you've got like five engineering teams and one researcher, it's kind of hard to get their time for understanding the implications of the product you're launching or understanding the data around what people are doing with it. So I was like, okay, we need to be performing this analysis. There isn't anyone to perform this analysis. Sod it. I have no life. I will learn how to perform this analysis. It was October of 2013. I started digging into R. I signed up for Roger Peng's Coursera course, of all things, and ended up digging into the language and how to do analysis in it and, you know, get data out and graph it and all the rest. It constantly amazes me that I've continued doing it for this amount of time and that people turned around and looked at the stuff I was doing and went, you're actually pretty good at this. Maybe we should just make this your job instead of talking to people. But it's a place I'm comfortable to be in, I guess.
So I guess one thing that I'm curious about is, you know, so you've got log stuff at scale. You're looking at different types of logs and as one of the primary things that you do and for different stuff. For a lot of security folk, and I know you're not just a security person, but even non-security folk, this is almost the thing these days, their go-to tool isn't going to be R, right? And more often than not, it's going to be what I like to call the Excel of log data science, which is Splunk. Why R instead of like a Splunk type thing to do that, or even some of the other things that layer on top of HDFS and do kind of streaming based analysis? Like, you know, what drove you more towards R than those other tools?
A couple of things. One of them is simply background. So I started off using R, which was fine because I was dealing with relatively static MySQL tables, right? It was editor data, not reader data. So it's on a much smaller scale. And so when it came to sort of transitioning into access logs and reader-centric stuff, it was a lot less effort to take the tools I already had and adapt them than it was to learn an entirely new set of tools. There's this idea that transitioning between tools is relatively seamless. I think it has the possibility to be, but in practice, when you're transitioning not because you enjoy it, but because it's your job, you don't have that option. It may be the case that I could get things sort of done better with Splunk or with Python. Nobody was willing to give me sort of 2 weeks of not asking me things so that I could learn my way around Splunk or Python. So everything sort of had to be gradually accreted and learned as I went. And then the second reason is simply it gives you the whole hog, right? If I use Python for a thing, then I can, or like a HDFS streaming thing that plugs into Python or plugs into Scala or plugs into Java, that's great. I end up getting out the data and then I have to transfer it to something completely different for the visualization or for the statistical analysis or for both. The advantage that R gives you, I guess, is R is not great at all the things. There are some things, particularly scalar operations or streaming data, that it sucks at tremendously. But it's very, very difficult to find a thing you want to do in R and not have a way of doing it.
And even if you have to end up building that too, right?
Yeah, in a couple of cases. But hey, it was fun.
And actually, speaking of that, as building stuff because you don't have it, you and Bob, both of you, have been producing a lot of R packages recently. And Oliver, could you talk through some of your recent packages and some of the cool things that you've added to the community?
Sure. Some of these aren't necessarily recent. They're just things I've been working on that I'm particularly proud of. So one of them is URL tools, which is a package for URL handling. It's got an encoder, a decoder, a parser that breaks down URLs into their IETF components. It's designed to operate in a vectorized way. It's designed to operate on scale, and it's designed to be very, very fast. So R, by default, does not have a parser of any kind, and its decoder and encoder are scalar and have a lot of interesting bugs in them. They're slow as hell. URL tools is primarily written in C++ with just an R front end. And the consequence of this is that if you want to decode or encode a URL, with URL tools, you can do it 700 times faster than in base R on scale, and 4 times faster than Python on the same scale. And it's that second metric I'm particularly proud of, because there's the people who treat it like a conflict, I guess, between the two languages are always talking about how Python has speed on its side. And this isn't actually necessarily the case if you write clever code. The other things I've been working on are web tools, which is a package. It wraps around Hadley Wickham's reader for fast, file reading. It's optimized for web access log formats. So if you've got a common log format file or a squid log format file or any of those variants, there is a function that already knows what the fields are going to be called, how they're delimited, how to split things up, everything else. There's also rgeolocate, which takes a vector of IP addresses and geolocates them against the MaxMind binary files, which are fairly standard, or against a variety of web APIs. And then there's IP tools, which I've been working on with Bob, which is IP handling functions. So things like, is this a valid IP? Is it an IPv4 or an IPv6 IP? Is this within this certain range? Is this, how do I have an exported 4 field. How do I get the like earliest valid IP out of that for geolocation? That sort of operation. Those are the things I've been working on recently. I'm currently this weekend actually in a massive refactor of a couple of them to try and make the sort of general space of handling access log data in R more consistent, because previously a couple of them were sort of cobbled together.
And URL tools has a bit, like I think it's got many or most of the components from Jay's TLD extract package too, right?
Yes, which was great to include. I think actually we included it via a GitHub issue I opened, which had something like, together we could be stronger than we are apart, or something similarly, you know, ominously supervillain.
Yep. And thanks for putting that in there. It's a good addition.
No problem. It's good functionality to have. In fact, credit goes to you for the way in which you wrote it. I think I told you this, but I tried re-implementing the same functionality in C++ rather than implementing it in R as you had, and the fastest I could get it was 5 times as slow as TLD expect.
There was a little bit of effort I put into the efficiency of that thing. So.
Yeah, it's very well optimized for large vectorized operations.
That's great. Thank you. There was also some chatter that we've had on the side, and I don't know if you want to talk about this publicly, but trying to look at text manipulation, text handling, NLP type things. Do you want to talk about what you're working on in that space?
Sure. It's fairly low, sort of early in incoates at the moment, although I've grabbed a couple of collaborators who know a lot more about sort of, latent data trick analysis than I do, which is always good. Admittedly, this covers pretty much anyone, but in this case, they actually know what they're doing. In R, we have this TM package, which is sort of a standardized package for text mining. It's good for what it is, but it has sort of a lot of legacy elements from the R environment as it stood in sort of 2005 to 2008. Heavy use of custom classes and object types, which makes it difficult to nest calls, not great documentation, an overt focus on like turning things into these special objects that you can't use to interact with the rest of R. One of the things I'm doing is writing a package which I've sort of called in my head TM2, not because it's a successor necessarily, but just because it really guarantees getting people excited about it if they've had to use TM, which breaks this down into what it actually should be, which is a corpus is a vector, and that's it. And then word stemming built in from the get-go, white space trimming built in from the get-go, everything based on compiled code, everything very, very optimized to try and get it as fast as it can possibly be over large corpora.
And you're, of course, going to break the two lowercase functionality, you know, a year after you release the TM2 package, right?
No, I'm going to call it like text miner or something.
Yeah, no, it's just like one of the pet peeves in the past, I guess, 9 months with TM is at some point last year they changed the way that they actually worked with normal functions in R that handle character vectors. Like before, you could have just called like two lower, just like you would have called remove stop words, and now you have to actually like wrap that with another function, so it turns it into a function that can act. So
oh,
I, it,
wow.
it,
yeah, oh, it's, they've got like a almost a map function for performing.
Yeah, it's terrible. So like, yeah, it's the this is you know like I think you'll get a standing ovation at any R conference if you actually manage to pull this off.
Yeah,
definitely.
It's not the first thing on my plate, but it's the thing I'm really excited about. The first thing on my plate actually is SCP bindings in R.
So you're still going to work on that?
Yeah, although probably port it to sort of native C rather than C++ because it just makes passing things around a lot easier.
And actually, speaking of R conferences, you just came back from Use R, right?
Mm.
Can you talk? So most folks that listen to our podcast probably have no idea that like there is an R conference, let alone that there's a giant one that's held every year. So can you talk a little bit about Use R, as well as kind of what you were doing there, and maybe even some of your thoughts on it? You know, because like you actually got to be there firsthand. Some pretty interesting things were announced this year. Mm-hmm. I'm just kind of curious from a firsthand view, like what you thought.
Sure. So Use R, for people who aren't familiar with it, is the annual R conference. It's been held every year since, I think we're up to like year 11 or year 13 now. It's one of those. This year is in Aalborg in Denmark, hosted at their cultural center, which was really fascinating because the writer of RCPP ran into Sting in the lift. That was the most interesting part of the entire weekend, to be honest. But from an R point, nerd's point of view, it was a tremendously fascinating conference. So it's 650 people from, you know, all fields, industry and academia, everything from I encountered an electrical engineer to biostatisticians to web analysts, all sort of noodling on ideas and presenting and trying to work out what we can do to push the language forward. And it was preceded by the R Summit in Copenhagen, which is the R Foundation's sort of core developer group getting together with other interesting people and talking about what they're working on next. And as a consequence of this, when you get to Use R, there's a lot of really, really smart people working on interesting things and also digesting sort of the latest announcements of big changes in the R world because they're so tightly linked. I haven't been to a previous Use R, so I can't say how it compares to other conferences in that sphere. I was very impressed with how well the conference was pulled off. There were some things that I would change, but they were mainly minor niggles about like name badges and how awkward they always are at every conference I go to. It was really, really well executed. It was incredibly well put together and timetabled. There wasn't enough air conditioning. Those are my sort of main recollections from the actual conference. But I thought the organizers did a fantastic job. I was there to present a piece of research I'd been doing with Jenny Bryan and David Robinson on software engineering standards in the R package community, namely there aren't any, which was pretty fun and made extra interesting by me losing my laptop and thus needing to ad-lib for 15 minutes in front of a blank screen in front of the R core team. They didn't actually hate it.
That's great.
There were actually some people came up to me afterwards and were like, I thought that not having slides was an improvement because that way people have to focus on what you're saying. And then the big announcement that sort of everyone was working on was the announcement of the R Consortium, which is a group of sort of industry giants who are interested in R. So Revolution Analytics, Mango Solutions, and R Studio from the R world, and then Microsoft and similar organizations from more of the industrial side. Sort of a wrapper around the R Foundation to handle, I'm sort of mentally thinking of it as the stuff the Python for Software Foundation handles that the R Foundation doesn't. So providing general drive and what the ecosystem will look like, identifying like particular needs that the community has or that their subset of the community has, that kind of, and putting effort into it, that kind of thing. Actually providing some funding and resourcing to the things that we've been doing. And so I spent my weekend sort of thinking on that and trying to not to let myself get distracted by thinking on that.
So I have a question, and Bob, maybe you can answer this too after Oliver, because you would fall in this boat too. But I mean, Oliver, you're very, very active, right? And you're writing these packages, and you know, you mentioned before you've been working at Wikimedia that you were a big part of the community there and things like that. So you're out in the community and you're doing stuff and you're contributing back to this larger group, right? What makes you so passionate? And I think a lot of listeners may ask, how can they get some?
What makes me so passionate? It depends if you ask me on a day when my imposter syndrome is kicking up or a day when it isn't. If it's kicking up, the answer is a bit of me is worried I might be a narcissist. I'm pretty sure that's not the case, but it's always a fear. More practically, it's I don't see the point of doing anything different. Like, my background has always been working in a wider sphere. From the age of 15, I started working on Wikipedia and being part of, as you said, like community-based movements. And I don't see the point of doing anything different. I don't see why you would write a tool for your use case and then not put it out there, unless you're restricted by, you know, NDAs or whatever, in which case, fair enough. But there's a rule I try and adhere to, which is I am not that original a person. Like, I'm reasonably smart. I'm not a genius. I'm not a tremendously original human being. I'm not pushing forward the boundaries of science and solving problems that have never been solved before. And that's not a put down, because what that means is the stuff I'm working on that I find hard, that I need to build tools to deal with, other people somewhere are probably working on too. And if I throw these tools out there, then their life is a bit easier and they can focus on the actual science.
And Bob, do you have anything to answer to that?
Yeah, actually, that's strikingly similar to myself as well. I mean, I along with doing, you know, packagey stuff, and we're almost, I think I challenged Oliver to a package war a couple of weeks ago. But I think a lot of it is similar to that. And like, I also do a lot of stuff on Stack Overflow too, just because I pick and choose on Stack Overflow, just trying to help people that are genuinely trying to seek help versus just trying to get you to write code for them for free. But it's more of like by helping the community, you are really advancing stuff. Like, by answering one of the questions on Stack Overflow, I helped a cancer researcher, like directly helped a cancer researcher do his job better, identify things better, and communicate his results better. That's kind of all awesome there. And by actually making packages that help other people do communication better, it touches a ton of fields that are often days feel more relevant than the one I'm actually in, because InfoSec just seems to be screwed up. I know every field's screwed up, but being actually in it every day, you get to see how good or bad it is. And then things come along, like this week, Kyle Walker, I think he's from Texas Christian, He's been doing a lot with geo-based stuff, and he released a new package that layers on top of the Tiger data, you know, all of the U.S. Tiger data sets, you know, all the shapefiles and data that come with that. And it's actually going to be a really great package because he's really identified an area where there was, I think, 3 or 4 different ways to do it in R, but not they were all kind of kludgy before. So he's doing that. And I'm like, well, this is a good thing because it's going to actually help a lot of people do this analysis better and communicate things better. So like I jumped on that over the weekend just because it's going to be a better thing as well. And I've actually talked with Oliver, too. I really think all of the spatial stuff in R needs what I would call a Hadley-like rewrite, you know, to make it more logical and more modern R feel to them, and maybe not completely redo it from the C or C++, but at least make it more logical in the way it operates, almost like the first way that the RVS package kind of worked before how they wrote XML too. So I just think it helps a wider range of people, and I think one thing that I like, and I'm this will go in right with another question I wanted to ask Oliver too, but I think it also helps people do stuff in R, because one thing that I'm kind of an R nut. I may be more of an R nut than Oliver, or maybe we're about equal on it. But I find R lets you focus on the solution, like versus the what of the solution versus the how of the solution. Like I at least find that you don't have to work on the minutia of trying to force something to be Pythonic with all of its brackets and stuff. And you get to actually just work on trying to solve whatever the problem is that you're having in R, because it tends to flow more naturally once you understand how R works. And maybe for some of the people that are really embedded in the Python community, that's the way that it looks to them, and Julian, whatever. I'm not trying to start a language war. But I just think that you can focus on it a lot more if you have all these other stuff better. Just like Oliver was saying about the text mining package, you know, if that was made more uniform and worked better with the way that native R handles objects, that's going to help a lot of people out, and that's going to really advance some of the data science you can layer on top of that with the latent directly allocate, you know, all that kind of stuff that's out there. It's going to be pretty cool. So the questions, so I guess like I lied about not starting a language or so. Do you do everything in R? Do you do stuff in Python? I mean, like I know that even in the past 3 or 4 weeks, there's been the attempt at a revival on the Twitters and the data science Twitters, which is like what 12 people. But for the whole R versus Python stuff, like people do those spurious, useless posts every so often. And I'm just curious about your philosophy of like, do everything in R, or do you use the tool that's the right tool for the job, kind of a thing?
Yeah. Data science is a wide field and a wide community, and the only people it shouldn't contain are people who attempt to artificially narrow who can be a part of it. That's my wider philosophy there. If you're posting, you know, R is in a war against Python, please leave. Most of the time, I do things in R, but not exclusively. So my stack is normally sort of in order of commonality, R, C++, Python, and Java. Java because HDFS. I'm sorry. That wasn't to you, that was to like 15-year-old me who had hopes and dreams and wanted to achieve things and is now seeing his future self write Java. So most of the time I use R, but it's the right tool for the job, right? So there's actually a really good example from just the last couple of weeks, which is we have a log system called Cirrus Search, which is built on top of Lucene. It outputs big log files, big poorly parsed and poorly sanitized log files, like 4 gigs at a time every day is in just, that's compressed. It's about 36 gigs when you untar it. And so I have to take these and parse them and turn them into something useful because they're not in HDFS yet and they're not sampled and we actually need that data. And the log lines are so badly formatted that what you're basically doing, if you want to extract a value, is running a regular expression over each row and then, you know, doing extraction. It's horrible, right? If I was trying to do this in R, I'd be in trouble. If I was trying to do this in C++, I'd also be in trouble because we don't have a version that supports the regex headers yet. So I use Python because Python is the right tool for a job. Generally, when it comes down to it, my approach to things is if I've got a static data set or I know how big it is and it's not, you know, 36 gigs, use R. If I need to stream through it, use Python. And it's as simple as that. Like, they are very different languages with very different foci, and using both of them is, at least for me, the best outcome. I have gripes about Python, but I have gripes about every language, so.
So you're doing a podcast as well. Right, and it's our podcast. Can you talk about that?
So it's called Our Talk. We're recording the technically the second, but the first, because it's the first one we're releasing, and R is one indexed, episode next week. It's hosted by myself, Mikhail Popov, who is a neuroscientist and R nerd, and actually, as of a couple of weeks ago, my sort of deputy at Wikimedia, except around machine learning, then I'm Deputy Mikhail. Jasmine Dumas, who is a student and GSOC participant and R nerd, and Kara Wu and Ted Hart sort of dropping in and out and doing their thing. Why we're mostly doing this, I think, because we all wanted there to be an R podcast and there wasn't. I sort of idly threw the idea out on Twitter a few weeks before deciding to kick it off and got kind of a phenomenal response from a lot of people being like, that would be perfect, just put it into 20 minutes so that I can listen to it in my commute. And so we decided to kick it off. The first episode clocked in at 60 minutes because we all like talking. So there's some work to be done.
Great.
First episode's coming up next week. We're hopefully going to be talking to David Smith about the from Revolution Analytics about the R Consortium launch. I don't know for sure yet. If not David, we'll have someone similarly interesting. And at some point, we need to get either one of you two on as well. Because one of my big focuses and one of the things I'm really fascinated about is it feels like most of the R community is dominated by biostatisticians, which is not a bad thing. It's awesome because biostatistics is fascinating. But I've always wondered, like, what about the R physicists or the R information security people or the R electrical engineers? Do these people exist? Can we find the one person in that crowd and, like, drag them out and ask them why there aren't more of them and see what we can do to help?
Great question.
Yeah, that is actually. I think that'll be a great series of great shows as you find individuals in different disciplines who are doing some of this stuff and be able to communicate that.
Yeah, it's going to be fun.
So is there anything that we haven't covered that you wanted to say to the masses of the data-driven security podcast community?
Not that I can think of, except that you should all be following InfoSec Taylor Swift on Twitter.
Oh, gosh, no. don't encourage them. No, oh, gosh.
So, Oliver, do you have any events coming up, any traveling or anything coming up?
So I'll be talking at Earl 2015, that's the Effective Applications of the R Language Conference in Boston in October, on actually the suite I've been working on, the sort of big web tools set of things and how they fit together and how you can use them to analyze access log data, which I'm pretty psyched about because I don't think I've ever given a talk that's just the whole thing before. I've just been like, you want to handle URLs really fast, use this thing, here's why. Other than that, I think that's the only upcoming thing of which I'm aware of. I'm sure the work will spring something on me at the last minute.
Great.
Actually, the Earl talks are going to be more lightning than talk, I think, too, given that they're all 30 minutes each. So it's going to be an interesting one.
And yeah. Bob, you're going to be there as well, right, Bob?
I will be there as well, talking about how we produce the Data Breach Investigations Report.
Ah, great topic. I may try to make that. I'm going to try to be out in Boston for that. It's in October?
Yep.
Try and get someone else to pay for it.
Well, I'll do that, definitely.
Good. One of my horrible discoveries was getting the email that was like, you're a speaker. Congratulations. You get in free on the day that your talk is.
Yes.
You
don't get the whole thing for free as a speaker. It's the weirdest. It's 30 minutes, so you get 30 minutes to talk about your thing, and then you get like, oh, if you want to come the next day and learn stuff the next day, you got to pay for it, which is just totally strange to me.
Yeah, talk about your thing and then attend a cocktail party. That is the stuff you get for free.
Yeah.
Wow. Really weird. That's interesting. That's a tough way to get speakers next year.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the thing I don't find it that uncommon. Like I talk to academic conferences a ton, right? And they're normally you present your paper and then you pay, and then it appears in proceedings of the blah 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 blah. The thing that confused me was not that they were charging money for speakers, or that they were sort of half charging money for speakers. Like I'm used to either you're speaking, you get in free, or you're speaking, you pay money. Not you're speaking, you get in free except when you don't. That was the bit that confused me.
Yeah. Well, Oliver, thank you so much for joining us. It was great having you on.
No problem. It was good to be here.